today we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about spirituality, religion, faith, and how that interacts with medicine, health, and wellness. We talked about how we define health and wellness and healthcare. And yesterday we spent, on the first session, and yesterday we spent some time talking about aging and how to and how maintaining good health helps us live a full and meaningful life. And there have been themes that have come through about aging gracefully, health as a resource, and from our quotes from Jimmy Carter and other people about the meaning in life is really giving to others. So the living is in the giving, and I think that's those are very, very true sentiments. When we talk about faith and medicine, I'd like to break it into two areas. One is just whether religious involvement or having a spiritual life impacts our health and our well-being in some way. And then spend a little bit of time, if we have time today, and if not, we'll talk about it tomorrow, is the role of intercessory prayer and whether that has a role in terms of health. If it does, can we measure it in any way? And is there any way that we can actually document that it does take place? And raise the issue of whether we even should be trying to document, or whether this is really another realm of human experience. There's been a historical relationship, as I think everyone knows, between the medical profession and religion, and it deals with very existential questions that people have when they become ill or face major crises in their life, and the questions really are, what's happening to me? When you feel ill or feel sick, what's going to happen to me in terms of predicting the future, and what can be done about that? And these are questions that I'm sure we've had for tens of thousands of years in the human experience, when we've faced various kinds of illnesses and sicknesses, and to a large extent, early in our historical life, the priest and the physician have been one and the same. Still are in some settings. Certainly, in the Native American culture, the medicine man and was also the holder of great mystical powers that derive from the Almighty in some way. It's not purely by accident that we can look at the great buildings of the Middle Ages and look at our medical centers today and see tremendous similarities. The great building in the Middle Ages, of course, were the cathedrals. Huge cathedrals dominated a town. If you drive over the bridge from New Jersey into New York over the George Washington Bridge, you're going to see a tremendous complex of buildings. Where I went to medical school, Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center, it is a huge complex of buildings. It just towers. It's the great modern medical center. You drive into Corvallis, Oregon, which is a little rinky-dink town down the road a piece, and you'll see up on the hill in the north edge of town, tremendous complex of buildings. It's the medical center. Dominating the landscape pretty much the way the cathedrals of the Middle Ages dominated the landscape. And not only was it the dominant architecture, but when you think of the priests in the cathedrals, you think of the physicians in the hospitals, wear special kinds of clothes, garments. Not the priests may have worn robes. We wear white coats. Or if you go into the operating theater, we really wear masked and gowned, very, and not anyone can go into the operating room. Just like the sanctuaries of the churches were special places, if we think about it, what takes place in the operating rooms is not unlike what took place in the Mayan temples or where the sacrifices and they read the entrails. Now we go in there as patients and we have our bellies opened up and the future is predicted for us. You've got a bad cancer and you're going to die soon, or it was really benign and you were going to live long and healthy. the similarity, I mean, it's almost uncanny. I am sorry that Jim is not here, because the poet would really see this.
He's working through the archaeology of Holden on garbology.
He's finding lots of things in that.
I wanted to mention that the other day we talked about gargoyles being on the old cathedrals. Well, those gargoyles were placed there as to ward off evil. And they weren't there decoratively, they were there to protect the people who came in. And they're really monsters. They're, sea monsters. They're really ugly.
That's precisely right. They weren't decorated. They weren't friendly things either.
No, they weren't.
They were
friendly.
Very unfriendly. To draw things away. Well, that's sort of not a lighthearted, but still maybe a poetic. I think Jim is making us think in more poetic terms in this Elder Hostel of the comparison of the similarities between what's taking place from a religious side and what takes place from a medical side, and in both cases it's to promote the healing and allowing us to live more full and productive and satisfying lives. There is a distinction, at least I feel a very strong distinction, and most writers do, between religion and spirituality. And I put up the derivation of the words behind us, where religion comes from religare in the Latin, which means to bind together. Mm-hmm. And so a religion is really a binding together of a group of people by ideas and thoughts. Some would say it's a dogma that holds people together, but it is a common system of belief that binds people together. That's very different, and that's sort of a broad definition of religion. One can bring it down to a very specific about a specific system of beliefs or dogma about a particular way of viewing God or the everlasting or whatever. But it could also be a more broad view of what binds community together. Spirituality, on the other hand, comes from the derivation of breath or breathe, and so it's a little different thing. It's more individual, less a binding together of individuals, and it's a broader, more dynamic concept. And it really relates a lot to a quest for meaning, for values, connectedness to the everlasting or to nature or the universe or some other kind of feeling. It does not have to involve spirituality. I don't think has to involve God in any way whatsoever. I think it can be a connection to the universe, to the earth, to a variety of ways of looking at where we fit as an individual into this big scheme of things that we don't understand. And we can't understand it all, and we can't be expected to understand it all, though it's a quest to understand it and to see where our place is. The majority of people, if you go out and ask people, are you spiritual, the majority of people will say yes. The majority of people will say that they are religious as well. When you try to make that the distinction, clearly many more people are spiritual than are religious. There are plenty of people who are very spiritual who don't ascribe to a specific religion, who don't feel they belong to a specific religion, and people in the Western world switch from one little religious group to another very freely. So it often depends on where their neighbors are going to church, which church they're going to go to in a community. They may find the Methodist church is where they really find a more satisfaction, or they go to the Lutheran church, or they go. Other people are very, throughout life, don't change, and are very, very consistent in their belief. There have been a lot of studies that have tried to relate being either spiritual or religious to health outcomes and health status, The data are pretty overwhelming that for individuals who do participate in religious activities, their general health status tends to be better. There may be a lot of reasons for that, and we can kind of discuss that. But just to give you some data, just to throw it out here, there have been 18 prospective studies looking at mortality. This is just at mortality rates, death, comparing religiously involved people with those who are not. And so it gets pretty tough sometimes. Well, how do you just know that, you know, that Marion is religious, and Karen isn't, or this one's more religious than somebody else. How do you do that? So one way is just say, do you go to church, and how often do you go to church or go to a service? And that's one way to do it. I think everyone around here will say, well, gee, that's not the best way to figure out whether somebody's really a good religious. But it is one way of looking at it. And it turns out if you attend church service or a religious service once a week or more versus somebody who goes rarely, in a big study with 5,286 adults aged between 21 and 65, there was a 23% reduction in the likelihood of death over a period of 28 years. Hmm. Long study, looking at people who consistently had a pattern of going to church versus those who were non-attendees, 23% reduction. Another study that lasted only 5 years and dealt with about 2,000 adults over the age of 55 showed a 24% reduction in mortality if you went to church once a week as opposed to not going at all or going less than once a month. So there really was a difference in overall mortality. Altogether, there were 18 studies. 17 of the 18 showed a positive relationship in terms of a reduction in death rates and mortality. One didn't. It was a veteran study of VA patients, and it didn't seem to make any difference if you were a veteran whether you went to church or not. Could be interesting. I don't know the significance of this, but there were a couple other studies that came out that when you were dealing with veterans are a little different group. At least people go to the Veterans Hospital for their care, or the Veterans Administration for their care. That they tend, religion doesn't seem to help them as much as it helps people who don't go there. Nobody's really looked at that, but I've just come across that on two or three studies.
What about a veteran going to church?
What about a veteran going to church?
Did they get twice as much?
Oh, was it worse? It just didn't make any difference. But there is a study. There was a study, and I will get to it. It had to do with mental health, and people actually did. The veterans who went to church actually did worse. And so religion isn't always positive with respect to...
Can I throw in a thought about veterans? You know, if they've been in combat, and most of them have, they have seen the very, very worst. They've been in hell, and they have killed people. I mean, this is a terrible thing. And I think that in the process of all this, you lose your whole sense of what is any of this all about. Where is God? You know, where is anything? And they come back just in not physically but emotionally all in pieces, and they just are unable to pull it back together again.
They're a different person.
They're a different person. They're a different person.
Could I throw in something on that too? The fact that they are connected. There is a great connectedness between veterans, uh-huh. And going to a place where veterans gather, you feel a great connection to that, just as one would to a church.
Yeah. Right.
And
because they've all suffered
the same
thing.
There's a connectedness between veterans.
So overall mortality rates are lower in people who go to church. In a study out of Israel looking at secular Jewish people as compared to Orthodox Jewish people, it turned out that the Orthodox individuals had, the secular group had the men had a four times greater risk of a first myocardial infarction than did the Orthodox. Interesting. Women, it was even greater. It was a seven times increased risk amongst the secular versus the Orthodox. In a study of Israeli civil servants, again comparing Orthodox to a non-religious Israelis, there was a 20% reduction in coronary artery disease in general amongst, and that was probably a better study than the other one, amongst the Orthodox Jews that worked as civil servants in Israel than those that didn't. Yes?
One thing that comes to mind in Israel is that Orthodox Jewish practice, of course, includes keeping Sabbath.
Yes.
So that might be an interesting part of that, the difference between those who take a full day of rest each week and those who may not observe that particular rest.
And they may follow dietary differences.
Right.
Eat less pork, no pork, and other things of that sort.
That's
why all these things are confounding. You know, is it really the church? Is it really the religious experience? Or is it something else about the individuals? Hypertension, same kind of thing. Church attendees have a lower incidence of hypertension than do in a study of essentially 4,000 people over the age of 65. So these are large people. They're cross-sectional studies. In some cases, they were prospective. As Eric just pointed out, maybe religious activities associated with other things, such as, and studies have shown that they are. Proper nutrition, more exercise, more seatbelt use. You look at people who go to church are much more likely to hook their seatbelts than people who don't go to church. They have lower smoking rates, and they're more likely to be successful in stopping smoking if they try, if they go to church on a regular basis. And they're much more likely to use preventive services. So people who go to church, essentially what it is that people who believe, especially people who believe a specific dogma or a specific collection of thought, are much more likely to follow advice and much more likely to obey authority. They follow authority. And in some cases that might be good, in some cases that might be really dangerous. If you follow orders and orders are given by a Nazi SS agent about executing somebody, then that might not be so good. If you follow orders to, get your mammogram and your pap test and you have your blood pressure checked and take your medicine for your cholesterol, then for your health, that might be good. Or hook your seatbelt. Yeah?
I just, last week in the Wenatchee paper, there was an article on obesity in relation to religion. And it brought out the amount of food within the churches. And they had various denominations. And the others, I can't recall all of them, but I do know the Baptists.
Baptists were the
fattest.
Yeah, no,
yes.
We had that ran out of local paper,
too.
That was kind of interesting.
It was interesting.
They looked at the percentage of people that were obese with different religions.
Yeah, I think it's the potlucks. I really
And bring your big
So there was a tremendous gradient, and it was Muslims and Jews had the least, and then it went up to the Southern Baptists were like 40% of the population is characterized as obese. Tremendous difference in the
But I wonder, it would be interesting to see whether just Southern people in general, because of what the eating habits.
You know, the other thing that correlates with that is income. And the lower the income, the higher the weight. And I think the south of our country has a huge percentage of poor people. I think that would follow.
But you also know that Oregon is right up there amongst the highest obesity.
That's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing, but it's true. But
Do you have any idea what might explain that?
I think Gay's comment is really a very good one. There is an inverse relationship between income, socioeconomic status, and weight. So that's related to a lot to exercise. It's related to the kind of food that people eat.
Fast
food is really cheap food, and which is why, I mean, it's not only because you can go to McDonald's and get it quick and it tastes good. You get a lot of calories for a relatively, the dollar meal.
Yeah.
You can go in there, and if you don't buy a soft drink, you can really load up on calories. Mm-hmm. Because a soft drink, it costs you more for a soft drink than it does for a Big Mac.
That's right.
And a soft drink is just some sugar water, whereas a Big Mac, you get a lot of fat. And that counts up. I think that really it plays a big role. And it's education, too, as far as what's a proper diet. People grow up without good education.
I'd like to go back to the churches. I don't know if this is prevalent in other churches, but a growing movement in the Lutheran churches is having parish nurses. We have two of them in our congregation. Yeah. Every Sunday they do a blood pressure clinic right before or between services, and they issue all kinds of health, and they also do home visits, and they go to the hospital, and you know they do a lot of the ministry type of things, but they bring health right into the congregation.
Yeah, I think we've seen, I mean, it's kind of interesting, I think what you say is absolutely true. You go back 100 years ago, 200 years ago, almost all the churches were run by, all the hospitals were run by churches. And they were staffed by nuns. Many of them were. And even the whole the profession of nursing grew out of a religious basis. We went with the advances of science in the 20th century. We swung away from that in a very major way, and started looking at used to be why did I Thor asked his medicine man, why have I got pneumonia? And the medicine man said, you did something wrong. And you're being punished. And now you have to go and have some kind of penance. And if you do it right and you straighten out your life, you're going to get better. And so that's the way that was handled. In 1970, Jim went to his doctor, Cliff, and said, why have I got pneumonia? And I said, it's because you got infected with a bug that somebody coughed on you. And here's an antibiotic, and you're going to get better. Didn't answer the question, but that bug, somebody coughed that bug on 100 people, but only one got sick. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the bug. I mean, it was more than the bug. I mean, if I treat the bug, the patient's going to get better, but there was something more to that. So now we've swung back, and now, Jim comes in to Dr. Cliff and says, why have I got pneumonia? And I say, it's your fault. You drink too much. You don't get enough exercise. You don't eat the right food. We've really swung. And by the way, here's the antibiotic that's going to help you. But you really have to straighten your life. We have really swung. Can you see what we've done? We've really come back to sort of a personal responsibility as well as the mechanistic cause of disease. To the extent that we put blame on people, that's not good. But to the extent that we can encourage them to recognize in their lives those things that they might be able to do differently. We might be able to draw together the spiritual and the personal responsibilities and the technology and science and come forward with something that really makes sense for us and that really will help us so that we don't get the pneumonia the next time, to go back and still drink too much and carouse and not eat good meals and not get the sleep we need, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that's just sort of a little aside. Being religious helps you deal with end-of-life issues. I think that's pretty obvious that might very well be the case. And we'll talk a little more about that. For mental health, if you do go to church, again, if you go to church or don't go to church, it seems to make a difference. Less depression, less anxiety in a large study, and a group of Muslim patients, just to say that God is not... if God has anything to do with this, going to church or being religious, that in a group of Muslim patients received standard psychotherapy and psychotherapy that was coupled with religious training, and the group that got the religious training with it did better and required less medication. I think we're probably aware that recovering from substance abuse and alcohol, people who do have a religious bent tend to do better. Suicide, there clearly is decreased rates of suicide in people who profess to believe in God than people who don't believe in God. Sort of a paradox in a way, because if you really believe that this is all there is to it, if you ended it, there's nothing, there's no life after death, there's no future, you wouldn't think that many of those people would really want to commit suicide. Whereas if you thought that you would have access to the next world, you would think that you would be more likely to commit suicide, but it's just the opposite.
But some religions don't accept you.
That's true
suicide.
Too, sure.
Yeah.
Why is it that religious people do better. We mentioned that they may embrace more healthy habits, diet, they follow prescriptions, they, I haven't heard anybody, they're probably religious people have fewer partly empty bottles of prescriptions in their medicine cabinets than non-religious people, because they took them all. You know, they took all the pills that they were supposed to, whereas, you know, I think all of us have, if we look at our medicine cabinets, we'll see that we have half-empty bottles of prescriptions that, well, we got better before we finished it, and we just didn't need to take those last few pills. Certainly, there's a connectedness. We talked about, Jimmy Carter talked about that, and we quoted him, a connectedness within religious communities that I think is of... is of great importance, tremendous social support. But it's probably not just those things, and there probably are some mechanistic things that happen as well, we are very complex biologic entities, and these social supports and these connectedness probably change very much our emotional response and our chemical responses in terms of the stress response, that we have lower levels of cortisol, that taking part in religious activities does lower one's blood pressure. You don't have to, it doesn't have to be a religious activity. I think Dr. Benson at Harvard, who's been published a book 30 years ago about the relaxation response and has continued to work in this area, you can reach a state of altered electrical activity in your brain, lowered blood pressure, lowered pulse, just by doing some very simple exercises, just by repeating a phrase, for example, being in a quiet place, taking 10, 15 minutes, and repeating a phrase that does not have a lot of emotional weight to it. It could be a number, you should just say 43, 21. Yes?
That made me remember a case study in the... the AMA Journal, I think it was in, June of 2000. It was a 79-year-old woman who was in chronic, unrelenting pain, and she was medication-resistant. And they had also tried alternative meds, and they had used massage, and I can't remember what the diagnosis was. But anyway, she was doing extremely well. She was doing so well that she would visit fragile elders in nursing homes and be somewhat inspirational to them. And so, of course, they were trying to find out, what is it that allows you to maintain so well? And she said that it was her love of Jesus. And then they said, well, but can you be more specific? And as it turns out, she took the precepts very seriously, but the precept that she had deeply internalized was, what person can add one cubit by to their stature by taking thought about the morrow? And so it appeared, and going back to what you were saying, that she was very devoted to living in the present moment. And she said when she coupled that precept with cast your cares upon the Lord, that those two sustained her. And it was absolutely remarkable the high level of mental health this woman had in a situation which would be crippling for most of us, psychologically and physically. But it was just like rock solid, that faith was just absolutely rock solid.
Thank you. Any other comments about how you think religion might, or participating in religious activities might be beneficial?
What can you say medically about situations that produce a certain lability or changeableness to blood pressure? I think when I go to church, my blood pressure goes up.
Jim's does too.
But I have other spiritual practices which I'm sure my blood pressure goes down. What does the medical community say about that swinging process of influencing long-term health?
We know very well, we know a lot more about blood pressure now than we used to, predominantly because there are ambulatory blood pressure monitoring devices that you can put on your arm, you can wear it for 24 hours, and it can record your blood pressure. Just going out and getting into an automobile as a driver will raise your blood pressure by 20 points, just like that, immediately. And it does it to everybody. But Some people have much greater swings than other people. They're called hot reactors. They call have labile hypertension. There's a lot of terms for it, but they really do respond very, very differently. This is all part of the evolutionary process. Raising your blood pressure when you had to get away from a saber-toothed tiger was a good thing. Your heart beat faster, you breathed deeper, you started to hyperventilate, you were ready to make that dash and get up a tree and get away from whatever was chasing you. It doesn't serve us anywhere near so well. There are many fewer saber-toothed tigers out there that we need the physical response. We may need the mental response, but the physical response that goes with it is not healthy. Bottom line is that yes, we do have these swings. The swings are important. Blood pressure taken just once or twice is not necessarily the best way to determine how well your blood pressure is being controlled. It is a way, and it's the most efficient, useful way. But in actual fact, for people who've been in to the doctor's office multiple times, and when they sit there quietly, the blood pressure is always normal, but they just have this feeling that their blood pressure may be swinging wildly, I think it'd be reasonable to ask your physician about having an ambulatory monitor and see what your average blood pressure is throughout the day, because that seems to correlate even better with your risk of stroke and heart attack than any one measurement. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is that if we could somehow seek the mean of our various readings through the day, we would have a very important piece of information.
Everybody's blood pressure is lower at night while you're sleeping. It really does drop very significantly. So even people with very significant hypertension, their blood pressures may very well be normal during the night, and then it goes up again in the morning and remains higher during the day. Just a normal cyclic variation.
Melissa, yes? What you were asking about the correlation between religion and health too. Part of it is a support system, that if you attend church regularly and are an active part of it, that you have the support system of those people. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that.
I believe that very much. Is a church the only place or religious facility the only place where you can get that support group? And the answer, of course, is no. You could find that elsewhere. But I think it's important to have that. And a church is an easy place to get it.
And there have been studies that show that the barbershop and the bar are two other places.
I think the bar, and I'm not sure if the bar, your blood pressure goes up in the bar when that guy's swinging his knife around your ear, you know.
That's what happened to me.
But, yeah, that's right. You've never been to a barbershop, right?
I went to law.
Oh, yes.
Are you aware of any clarification about the concept of dogmatic belief and longevity? People.
I'll give you my own opinion about that in a couple minutes here. Yes, I do. I have a. And in fact, we put up that data on the about life expectancy and how it doesn't correlate with finances and stuff. I was thinking about this last night, actually, in bed. where I shouldn't be thinking about these things, but and I was wondering, you know, Afghanistan, extraordinarily dogmatic belief, terrible life expectancy, horrible. Now there's poverty, of course, and then you look, United States very rich, and France, not as rich, but much better statistics. Now France is much more secular. I mean, everybody says, well, France, well, they're Catholics. Well, they don't go to church. I mean, the number of people in France that go to church is tiny. The Catholic Church is, as I understand it, is essentially dying in France. And France is very, very secular. United States is more and more religious, more and more dogmatic in its religion. And our statistics are not so good. And so I was lying there thinking, you know, I put these numbers up there, and maybe there's something else to this, that dogmatism in religion may actually be harmful for your health. I don't know that's true, and that's just was something I was thinking about last night. Anyway, that's... It's an interesting thought, and I don't know anyone's looking at that. I haven't seen anybody, and I don't think anybody really wants to do these studies of looking at a dogmatic religious sect that lives in one community, that same community, similar socioeconomically, versus a much more secular group of people, and see and see whether that made a difference. We know going to church seems to help, and that would imply that dogmatism is good. But there are some real negative effects of religiosity as well.
Get into extremism, then.
Fanaticism. Yeah, and you may walk around angry. I have a feeling that extremely strongly dogmatic people may walk around angry a lot because they look around and they see all these other people that are just not seeing the world the way they see it, and that is upsetting to them.
Yes.
And so that's a constant source of tension in their lives, as opposed to accepting that there is this huge variety of thought in the world, and that nobody that I know has the absolute truth and a certainty that what they believe is the truth. Yes.
And along with that, anger may go a lot of guilt too if they're constantly behind in their following of this dogma. And that can have a good effect on you.
But there were some sociological studies that were made of the Dukhobors, and among the women, there was a great deal of depression, if I remember correctly. But there has been some sociological studies of those that had a very strict way of life, mm-hmm. and one was the Dukhobors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, women tend to really get in the strict of the religion. They tend to be male-dominated religions, as we know, and whether it's a strict Mormon religion or it's a strict fundamentalist Mormon or fundamentalist Islamic or Christian, women tend to be suppressed in those, at least suppressed the way most secular people would look at that. So negative effects of religion with respect to health. Certainly there are people who will avoid appropriate treatments, appropriate care that we would consider appropriate care for religious reasons. Mm-hmm. There are some religious sects that don't believe in immunizations. They take advantage of the herd immunity that everyone else gets the immunity, and then to say that their kids don't have to. And we have a problem in Ashland, Oregon, which is a very liberal little community down there, where people, they say it's for religious reasons. In some cases it is. In some cases they just use that because they're afraid that the immunizations increase autism or something else. And they don't want their kids immunized. And that exposes the whole population to risk of recurrence of some of these really bad childhood diseases that our kids don't have to worry about now. Transfusions in Jehovah's Witness. I mean, that's not good for your health if you're bleeding to death. To have that belief, it may get you into heaven, or it may not, but it will certainly get into heaven quicker than if we could give you a blood transfusion. And the state has recognized that and say it's anybody can refuse care, but you can't refuse it for your underage child, if that child is bleeding to death. It can get carried too far. So a child has leukemia. Leukemia is not a good example because we can actually cure leukemias. But if it were extreme treatments for a condition that might not cure a child, should the state have the right to force those kinds of therapies on a child if the parents feel very strongly against it? For a blood transfusion, I would say if a child was hit by a motor vehicle and severed an artery and was bleeding to death, I think the state has every right to step in. And I don't know, that may be a controversial area. Maybe not everyone here agrees with that and believes that a parent ought to be able to say, I would rather have my child bleed to death than to have them receive a blood transfusion because this is going to affect their everlasting life. Most of us would look and say, well, that's a silly belief. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't make sense. But to people who believe that, it makes total sense.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to know at what point do you step in. Child abuse in fundamentalist religious sects, I think this whole thing with the Mormon, this polygamy is really a form of child abuse of young women, young girls. And that's religion. That's in the name of religion. That's in the name of yeah, there are some very harmful things in medicine, medically, that relate. And we all know about the cults with mass suicide, Jonestown and things of that, the Branch Davidians and a lot of weird stuff that goes on in the name of religion. In one study, it was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 2001, if you're very religious and you are going through a religious struggle, if you feel your illness is caused because you did something wrong and God is punishing you, or that you that you're angry at God because of something's happened, or that you feel that the devil has been in somehow involved in your health or the health of someone you love, those people really do poorly, and they had an increase of up to 28% in mortality over 2 years. So religious struggle is not good for your health. Maybe good for your mind and working through a lot of these things, but it is not a good thing.
When you're sick.
We should point out that Freud, the father of modern psychology and psychotherapy, felt that all religious belief was a form of psychotherapy. Was a form of psychopathology. He did not believe that a normal thinking person could possibly hold any of the religious beliefs that that so many people do hold. That is not the current holding of modern psychiatry or psychology, but it is still held by some people. And clearly, if you want to find a population that has heard directly from God, you can go to my psychiatric institute we have in Corvallis, where I do, our group does physical examinations. We take part of the physical part just to make sure they don't have diabetes or heart disease or something else going on when they're hospitalized. If you look at the hospitalized group, it is amazing how many it's two things about that. One is that meth is a huge, terrible epidemic here in the North. That's the first thing, and if you want to leading the cycle, methamphetamine is just a huge problem. That's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. But you will find extraordinarily religious people in the psychiatric institute who think they're God, have spoken to God, have special connection to God, mysticism, see things. I mean, that is a big part of psychotherapy. People who can't make it on the outside. You know, I mean, there's a lot of psychopathology everywhere, but
especially schizophrenia.
Yeah, and so there's a real connection there to a type of religion, a type of mysticism, a type of seeing visions and things of that sort.
Not mainstream.
No, not mainstream. No.
We've got Eric in the room today with us. What are they teaching you in seminary about this intersection between religious and spiritual beliefs? Health and spiritual belief.
Yeah, right. You know, I'm not sure that I had much actual class time devoted to this. My experience with some of these issues was required what's called CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. And I spent a summer working as a chaplain in a hospital. And there, I think, it seemed to me in the institution itself was trying to take very seriously. It's not wasn't a religiously affiliated hospital, but the institution itself was trying to take very seriously spirituality and its effect in the healing, and its effects in the healing process. And so the conversation there, so you'd expect it in the chaplain's office for that to be there, but the institution as a whole, and physicians too, were interested in our conversations with patients and our sense of how they were doing. And not every physician and not every nurse was interested in those kind of conversations. But that was my perception. I don't know if that answers your question about what we're being taught in seminary. I don't know if that.
Well, as we started out the conversation by saying this is a historical link, we continue the conversation as though these are very close, and I'm wondering, is it treated as very close in the same?
I'm not sure that it is. I'd say traditional seminary education, you know, is maybe based on a little bit, the curriculum might be based on a little older model where the role of healing is not, I don't know, the role in healing is not emphasized. I would say, one thing I think that's very fascinating is that now the Lutheran Church is publishing a new hymnal, a new worship book coming out soon. It will have in it a rite of healing, healing service, which of course has been a part of the church's tradition for years, and then in the last century or so we were pretty uneasy about even talking about those sorts of things. Well, now it's going to be back in. And so I find that fascinating.
That's a giant leap.
Yeah.
The only school that I know of is Fuller Theological Seminary, which has made a major step in the direction of blending theology and psychology in their school of psychology. I'm pretty aware of this.
In California,
at Pasadena.
At Loma Linda?
Pasadena, California.
Yeah.
Fuller Theological Seminary.
Oh, okay.
Where they have a school of psychology, and if you're going to become a psychologist, you have to take both Greek and Hebrew to understand the writings of both the Old and the New Testament, because they really believe, I mean, that when you're dealing with a patient, there's some aspect of integration of spirituality that also has to be addressed.
Go ahead, Captain.
A couple of things I could say from a psychological perspective. Carl Jung, found when he listened very carefully to the language of schizophrenia, that a lot of it sounds like salad language, but if you can spend significant amounts of time with these individuals, you find that there really is a logic that comes through that really does need to be honored. So I want to put that out. And then the other thing I would say is that there are psychologists that are some are trained in the Swedenborg methodology, and that's all linked into some of the ancient beliefs, particularly of the Eskimo people, that with the use of drugs, evil can enter the body, that you open yourself for evil. And then that leads more into this area that would shade over into exorcism more than the kind of pathology that labels and kind of puts people in a box. And I think a lot of that is really interesting. What negates the effectiveness is always management and the lack of time to really open up fully a human being. But if you've been around people that are trying to clear up with meth, very much like the DTs, it would seem that there are forces there that do seem very dark.
Pretty good. With respect to Eric's comments, I have seen in the past 10 years in my hospital considerably increase in the activity of the chaplain's service. They've increased. We now have three chaplains that work in our hospital, where we used to have one. They're just much more active in their interactions with the staff and with the patients. Part of it is that our patients we deal with now are sicker than they used to be in the hospital, and that these are more existential questions are being raised about what's going on with them. And so many of the problems that people have are not only medical, but are social. So many people, and many of us will be facing this, we seem to be getting along in our own homes pretty well. And you say, God, that person's just doing great. They're 87 years old. They were doing great. And all of a sudden, something happens, a broken leg, a heart attack. The whole world tumbles. You know, it's been two elderly people taking care of each other, and they've been leaning on each other, and then one pillar kind of collapses out of there and suddenly needs a lot of care, and the whole system just kind of falls apart. Where are these people going to go? They have to get into a retirement home. They're going to be in a nursing home for a while. They need rehab. These are huge social problems, and the chaplain, the social workers, can be a huge help. Because they're beyond our capability as physicians to even begin to address some of those issues. You know, we can take care of the broken leg and the injured heart, but we certainly can't take care of all these other issues that come upon. The chaplains do a great job. We're all going to go on a hike in a minute. We didn't get to the intercessory prayer part, and we'll do that tomorrow. I think it's an important, that's really an important area to talk about, to look at what kind of data are out there, what are your own experiences have been. And we're going to do a little experiment tomorrow. I mentioned briefly my very good friend who introduced Gay and me to Holden 7 years ago at the first elder hostel that we came to. His son was the medic, spent a whole year here as a physician medic. And he was asked, the son was asked to participate in an elder hostel. He was a little unsure about doing it himself. He wanted his dad, who was a 80-year-old experienced oncologist. His dad asked me to come along to sort of be at his shoulder. So we had three generations of physicians here. And that's how I got introduced to Holden, and I'm sort of the survivor of the group here. He's dying. He's dying of congestive heart failure. And we're going to talk about intercessory prayer tomorrow. And I'll talk a little more about David Cleaver and his remarkable life. And I'm going to ask everyone that believes that prayer might help tomorrow to pray for him. He knows that one day up here, he doesn't know which day. I told him that one of the days of the week, he knows we're up here. He would love to come up here. He loves the mountains. And even at the age of, he was last year, I think, 2001, I guess, because we were here during the 9/11. And he hiked up to Heart Lake and Holden Lake slowly, but he went the whole way, and he was in his mid-80s at the time. That he knows we're going to pray for him on one of those days, but he doesn't know which day. And I've asked him to kind of see whether one day is going to be a little bit better than any other day. So when I go back to, when we go back, it's a little bit of science and a little bit of humanity and a little bit of spirituality, a little bit of religion, and a little bit of friendship, and a little bit of just wanting him to feel a little bit better, because we're not going to cure him. I mean, he's not going to be cured by anything we say or anything that God does or anything else. But he is, he might feel better on one of these days, and you might have a good day. And the other thing, the letter that Gay wrote the other day was to his wife, and she's struggling, as you can imagine. And maybe part of those prayers will be to see if she can have some healing herself in her relationship with him as he goes through this crisis in his life. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be kind of interesting, and I'm kind of, you know, you're such a wonderful group of people, and I'm just really looking forward to going back to Corvallis, and believe it or not, I really hope that he had the good day. I hope he had a lot of good days while we were gone, but it would open my eyes a whole lot if in fact his best day was the day that we all made a concerted effort. So we're going to do that tomorrow. So don't pray today for me. Now I'll screw up my study. Yes, Jim.
Put his name on the board so we can.
I can do that right now. So actually, you certainly. His name is David D. Cleaver.
Can't read it. Get it over there.
Well, you can come up and kind of. D-A-V-I-D for David. Cleaver is K-L-I-E-W-E-R.
Pronounce Cleaver.
It's pronounced Cleaver, like Eldridge Cleaver, but it's spelled differently.
Cliff, do you think there's been somewhat in medicine where I think with all of the specialties in that, and I can see that reason, but where we have segmented the person, body, mind, and soul, and we have, you treat the body, this takes care of the mind, and the soul, I'm wondering, and we're searching to come back as a whole, you know, and that we're a whole person, we can't, each one interrelates to the other. You know, if I'm affected spiritually, that's going to have some maybe effect physically in me, but I'm not always tying that in. Or the, you know, I often think, you know, it's body, mind, and soul, and we've separated everything. And now we're trying to get this back together, and that we're interrelated.
We are much more, I think, yeah, I think what you said is absolutely right. We're much more than the sum of our parts.
Yeah.
We're not just a binding. In the same way, a cardiologist really unfortunately, and medicine has evolved this way, is that a cardiologist really looks at your heart. There are very few cardiologists that really look at the whole thing. In the same way that, you know, the geologists look at this rock, but somebody like Dawn can look at how this rock relates to the entire into the entire Earth and then the universe, for that matter. So it takes somebody special to try and pull those things together. Anyway, thank you for your time and attention and contributions. Thank you for coming, Eric.